You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the June 2023 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of The Hangover by Joy Press and Natalie Jarvie. Cynicism about the industry is, more than ever, the mood of the day. What they're doing is going to create an erosion of the quality of the product, says Brittany Nichols, a writer-producer on Abbott Elementary. I just don't understand how you could piss off writers, piss off your audiences, and then tell them, but we need you to sign up for these 18 different streaming services. Another writer puts it this way, when someone comes to me with an idea now, I'm like, who gets murdered, or where are the zombies? You can hide cool character stuff in the zombie show, but you can't just have a show about cool characters anymore. Showtime, which like HBO is one of the original prestige cable networks, is being integrated with Paramount Plus. Chris McCarthy, who oversees Paramount Media Networks and Showtime, speaks plainly about his franchise-flavored ambitions. We're not playing to the coast. We're playing to the center of the country and the coast, he says. I think we proved the model first with Yellowstone, that you make a premium scripted series into a franchise and make it fresh and new. Franchise fever is also driving McCarthy's plans to extend the universe of series like Dexter and Billions. Look out for millions and trillions. What the franchises do is just set a much more stable base that brings us a mass audience. So we're much more profitable from the beginning, but then we have to build on that, McCarthy says. I think the misconception was the winners are always going to be the ones with the most amount of content, when in fact, the winners are going to be the ones with the most mass hits. And what breaks through that clutter for most people is franchises. No one would ever question the rise of Yellowstone and the Taylor Sheridan universe. But franchises aren't always sure things. So many hits are made by taking chances, by doing something that hasn't been done before, says a studio executive. A lot of buyers are saying, we're looking for our Game of Thrones. What's the next Stranger Things? That's never how a hit show comes to be born. That, for me, is the most depressing part of this time. The pandemonium has rattled many of streaming's creative bosses. The fact that business is chaotic and you don't know what's going to hit is undermining executive confidence, says showrunner Glenn Mazzara. During the pandemic, people really felt that the audience would not want anything dark, so everybody was looking for a hopeful Ted Lasso-type thing. And then the biggest show of that period was Squid Game, which was dark. Do you understand how terrifying that is for people who have mandates to find anything but that, and yet that's the one that hits the jackpot? Another concern is that this new caution will damage streaming's gains in terms of diverse programming. The streamers were ready to take risk and bet on talent in a big way, says a female showrunner. In the early days, it didn't feel like the ordinary system because they were in a rush. They bet on you and they stood out of the way. Now, at many places, she says, the parent company is getting nervous and wanting to see results and wanting to see profits, so you see them starting to put the brakes on. And who tends to get shut out whenever there's a retrenchment? When these executives are really trying to play it safe, says a streaming writer, they're not going to first-time showrunners who might be women or people of color. So what does the next decade look like in an industry where creativity increasingly means Wall Street telling tech companies like Netflix and Amazon what to do? I have this dystopian vision of the future where it's like that second half of WALL-E, says one streaming writer. We're all in those pods constantly being fed content curated for us, but it's all created by AI. Still, it's impossible not to feel for the studio execs, given how much pressure they're under just to survive. This is a time for us to rethink the way we do things, the way we develop, the way we sell, the way we work with our deals, says one. We've adjusted our slate to be budget conscious, whether that's looking for shows that are in a limited location or can be genre but shot with some constraints. We're just looking to get wins on the board. Some of today's platforms likely won't survive the cull. Paramount Media's McCarthy talks about the challenge with the rugged enthusiasm of a football coach urging on his players. You have to run into change. You have to love it, he says. This business is driven by change, and that's the exciting part. It's like you get to reinvent the world in real time and create some new ones. For those of us who have grown to love the Wild West of streaming, with all its rogue thrills and unexpected treasures, its original voices and undiluted visions, there's some real sadness at the thought that this was all just a transition to some kind of more profitable new normal. But Garrett Bash, an executive producer, has found a potential upside that's at least a little comforting. The past few years definitely have been a gold rush, he says, but I also think it's been kind of a gold rush of trash. A lot of things have been made that probably shouldn't have been. This fiscally responsible new streaming model is not going to take the talent away, but I think it can help take out the trash. the V-Files. In 1983, when Kenneth Johnson set out to create a parable about fascism, he had no idea that his alien invasion miniseries V would become a cult classic, or that decades later, the far right would seize on the show as proof that body-snatching lizards really do walk among us, by Anthony Bresnahan. Opening photo, Leapin' Lizards. These aliens, led in part by Jane Badler's cunning scientist Diana, said they came in peace. Even 40 years later, V is still getting under people's skin. The writer, producer, and director Kenneth Johnson has never stopped getting fan mail about the miniseries he created back in 1983, which rattled America with its depiction of cold-blooded authoritarians conquering the world. The invaders in red jumpsuits, dark glasses, and ball caps were actually beings from another planet. But Johnson intended the sci-fi drama to be more than mere escapism. To him, it was a warning. When he gets new letters from viewers, Johnson opens them hoping they got the message, which seems as obvious to him now as it did back then. I got to thinking, God, how would everyday people feel if suddenly there was a sea change in our life that turned it all around? If suddenly some hyperpower rolled over us, just like the Nazis rolled into Europe, he says. But in recent years, far-right conspiracy theorists, QAnon followers, and garden-variety lunatics have instead homed in on the fact that V's extraterrestrials were secretly reptilians disguised as humans to mislead us. Many harbor a sincere belief that a reptoid cabal really does control the world. I've gotten emails over the years and letters from people on the fringes who say, "Oh, you get it," Johnson says. "You know that there are lizards among us." This is just one twist in the real-life saga of V, a show that changed television by bringing blockbuster scale to the small screen while presenting an eerily prescient political allegory that most viewers saw clearly. The title had two meanings. V stood for the visitors, who appear in our skies promising medical advancements, astounding new technology, and good old-fashioned peace for our time. It also stood for victory, the battle cry of the rebellion that forms when the newcomers are revealed as scaly predators. As their power grows, the aliens round up resistors, who become their favorite new source of food. V was watched in more than 33 million homes, which amounted to 40% of all TV viewership. The most popular series in America today, Yellowstone, averages 13.1 million viewers per episode. V's popularity spawned a second miniseries, then a weekly show, and decades later it was remade in a glossy 2009 reboot. Although memories have faded over the years, it retains a robust cult status. Red-suited invaders can still be spotted among the cosplayers at conventions. Few fans are likely aware of V's backstory, its origin as a pure anti-fascism parable devoid of extraterrestrials, or the horrific true life crime that shocked its cast and crew when one of its stars, Dominic Dunn, was savagely killed and another became embroiled in the tragedy as a witness. And despite the show's success, Johnson was forced out, leading to the eventual collapse of the franchise. The making of V could be a primetime soap opera of its own. Today, Johnson hopes to reclaim the show from the executives who bungled it, from the conspiracy obsessives who misunderstood it, and from the reliquary of Nostalgia TV. He is actively trying to remake it as a series of movies, believing its themes are more relevant than ever. Now 80, Johnson is a lean and limber presence, battle-scarred by his years in the Hollywood trenches, but still energized. With his ginger-gray beard and ring of hair, he bears a striking resemblance to Don Quixote. V is now, and has always been, his impossible quest. In the early 1980s, Johnson was among Hollywood's top TV showrunners, having written for The $6 Million Man and created its spinoff, The Bionic Woman, as well as the Marvel series, The Incredible Hulk. He wanted to use the clout he'd established to create something more significant, something that would last. Sinclair Lewis's dystopian 1935 novel, It Can't Happen Here, was his inspiration. The book was written by the Nobel laureate at the time of Mussolini's rise in Italy and Hitler's takeover of Germany, and Lewis intended it as a warning to complacent Americans that their democracy was more vulnerable than they realized. Decades later, Johnson believed the premise still had resonance. In Lewis's book, the United States is torn apart by a flamboyant blowhard politician who uses fear-mongering and empty promises to the working class to win election before consolidating his power, shattering the traditions of governance, breaking any laws that constrain him, and stoking paranoia and division. The executives at NBC, which two decades later would premiere a show called The Apprentice, found this all to be far-fetched. Next, photos. Among Us. Humanoid troops stand guard after imposing martial law on Earth in the original 1983 miniseries. A visitor's true face is revealed. Diana enjoys a healthy snack. Brandon Tartikoff, who had been president of entertainment at NBC for about a year, wanted something bold to revive a network stuck in last place. He would become legendary for programming hits like Miami Vice, The Cosby Show, Law and Order, The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, and Seinfeld. But in 1982, none of those existed. He quickly committed to making Johnson's miniseries and possibly turning it into a weekly show, but he had notes. He said, "I don't know that Americans will get fascism," Johnson recalls. I said, "Well, it's not a complicated concept, Brandon. You put on a brown shirt, you shave your head, and you beat somebody up." But, he said, "couldn't it be an outside force, like the Soviets or the Chinese?" A programming executive sitting in the meeting chimed in. A young guy named Jeff Sagansky was sitting in the corner. He said, "How about aliens, Kenny?" Johnson says, and I went, "Ugh, I just didn't want to go in that direction." Tartikoff died in 1997, but Sagansky, who went on to become president of CBS Entertainment and later co-president of Sony Pictures, remembers that conversation. "I got up, I went to the window, and I said, 'Picture small spaceships buzzing up and down Burbank Boulevard,'" Sagansky says. "These aliens, they say they're coming in peace." Johnson left the meeting with his fuse lit. "I freaked out," he says. "I didn't want to get so typecast as the sci-fi guy." As he cooled off, he started thinking about ways it might work. Rod Serling had created powerful social commentary using genre tropes in The Twilight Zone, and Ray Bradbury had done the same with his books. "I went home that night, and I realized that Jeff had a really brilliant idea," Johnson says. "V was always about how individual people react to power. Some will suck up like the Vichy French did to the Nazis, and others will try to keep their heads down. The heroes say this power is being abused and we've got to fight back." V was personal for Johnson. He grew up in households where bigotry and intolerance were commonplace. Born in Pine Bluff, Arkansas in 1942, he was an infant when the family moved to Washington, D.C. during World War II, so his enlisted father could serve on a general's staff. His parents divorced when he was four. "Daddy went back to Arkansas," he says. "I would visit him and my southern relatives in the summer, but I was raised outside of Washington, D.C. by my mother and stepfather, a Yankee from Worcester, Massachusetts, who was a bigger bigot about black people than she was. Plus, he was really anti-Semitic." Johnson's biological father, meanwhile, espoused dehumanizing conspiracy theories about people of color, none of which his son ever believed. For some reason that I can't completely account for, it never stuck, Johnson says. Next photos, Earthbound, Dominic Dunn, whose death traumatized the production, and David Packer. Kenneth Johnson crouching on set, the new guard in power. In the mid-1960s, working as a producer on The Mike Douglas Show, he came to see how effectively mass communication could make distasteful views palatable. The affable Douglas was a daytime version of Johnny Carson, regularly featuring politicians, celebrities, athletes. Johnson was promoted to showrunner at 25 after his predecessor, a young TV producer named Roger Ailes, who'd later become an infamously toxic power broker at Fox News, befriended Richard Nixon during a guest spot in 1967 and quit to become his presidential campaign's first ever media advisor. Johnson recalls being tempted to join up himself. "I got a call one night. Kenny, it's Roger and Dick," he says. Dick, of course, was Nixon, who told him, "I want you to leave the show. I want you to come with me. We're going to do this big Madison Square Garden rally. Roger tells me you're a great director." Johnson says he quickly came to his senses, telling the duo, "Thanks very much. I don't want to do that kind of stuff." Left unsaid was, "And do I want to be your guy?" "No. Now, if Bobby Kennedy had asked me, that would have been a harder call," Johnson says. V would be Johnson's treatise on the corrupting allure of prejudice and power. If that had to have lizard people, so be it. Johnson rewrote his script to focus on an alien invasion, and V got the green light. With NBC's commitment to air it, Warner Brothers signed on to produce the four-hour miniseries for about $8 million. Roughly the same that George Lucas had gotten for Star Wars 6 years earlier. But it all had to be done fast. From the day that Brandon read the screenplay on a weekend and said go until the day that I said action was 2.5 weeks, says Johnson. NBC needed to air V in May 1983, a sweeps month when viewership directly influenced advertising rates. But the tight schedule meant longer days and weekend work for the crew. Between that and all the visual and makeup effects, V's price tag climbed ever higher. V was an ensemble story with a vast cast, focusing on a young med school student named Juliet Parrish, who goes from working in a lab to leading a revolution. A TV cameraman named Mike Donovan, whose camera captures the visitor's true nature, and a ruthless visitor enforcer known only as Diana, who is tasked with quietly crushing the resistance, while her alien superiors gladhand Earth's leaders and put a reassuring public face on the invasion. The rebels gain strength from people on the margins of society. Immigrants, blue-collar workers, the elderly, and even assorted outcasts and outlaws, while those with more established status in society grudgingly accept the visitor's gradual changes. A few humans even collaborate with the aliens, such as an embittered young man who derives power from reporting dissidents, and a wealthy woman eager to elevate herself in the new hierarchy. She also happens to be the mother of Donovan, the alarm-raising journalist. "That was my mother," Johnson says. "She was that woman." There were a few good aliens who turned against the invasion, such as Willie, played by Robert Englund. After a decade of bit parts in movies, the actor became a star on V as a kind-hearted comic relief visitor who didn't want to hurt anybody. Ironically, he would break even bigger a year later, playing the claw-fingered Freddy Krueger in A Nightmare on Elm Street, who only wanted to hurt everybody. England says V's veiled World War II references were clear to everyone working on it. If you were around then, you have to ask yourself, what would I have done? The cast was mostly newcomers, with a Juliet Parrish role going to 25-year-old Faye Grant. Her character worked at a biochemical research lab before turning into the ad hoc leader of a rebellion. Since scientists can expose the true nature of the human-looking aliens, they are the first group vilified by the visitors. For inspiration, Grant reached out to Marie-Madeleine Fourcade, who had been 30 when she led a spy network during the Nazi occupation of France, funneling information about German activities to Allied forces. She lived in Paris at the time. She was elderly, and it took an effort for her to speak, Grant says, so they corresponded by letter. I wanted to know what moves a person to do something like that. She was married with kids and was the least likely person to join the underground and become a leader. Fourcade happily answered all of the actor's questions. And what did the real-life Nazi fighter think of lizard people? It was difficult to explain the science fiction component, Grant admits. The other lead of V, the crusading TV journalist, was modeled on the newspaper editor turned revolutionary in It Can't Happen Here. Johnson hired a 34-year-old Merck singer, star of the sword and sorcery movie Beastmaster, to play Donovan, who was attacked and forced into hiding after capturing footage of the alien's true plan. I think that's the quality of heroism that Kinney was most interested in, the ordinary citizen who suddenly found that his morality and ethics were strained, Singer says. The key alien role was the alluringly deadly Diana, and Jane Badler, a 28-year-old who was then starring in the soap opera The Doctors, was chosen to play the otherworldly apparatchik. I didn't have any humanity, she says. Most people, somewhere there's a spark of kindness, there's a spark of compassion, but with Diana, no matter how deep you went, it wasn't there. The breakneck pace of V's production became apparent to Badler immediately. The day after her audition, Badler found out she got the job. I got a note and it said, "Don't leave town," she says. The next thing I knew, I was being fitted for a big prosthetic. Badler's character would supply the shock scare in which viewers learned the visitors were actually there to feast on Earth's large, plentiful group of mammals, us. The special effects artist hurried to create a fake version of Badler's head that would be built around a mechanical jaw that unhinged like a snake's so Diana could gobble down a large living rodent. The crew also constructed a contraption for the follow-up shot using an inflatable device disguised around Badler's neck to create a series of bulges, simulating the furry creature's journey down Diana's gullet. Now, of course, we look at it and go, "Oh, give me a break," Badler says of the effect. But at that time, people were so frightened of that. They saw that big fake head eating that rat, and they really thought it was me. One of the most emotional subplots of V involved an elderly Holocaust survivor named Abraham Bernstein, played by the late Leonardo Cimino, who realizes that the visitors, what the visitors are up to when scientists and reporters start disappearing. He offers to shelter an anthropologist and his family, but his grandson Daniel, played by David Packer, is a troubled kid who idolizes the visitors, dresses in their uniform, and collaborates as a member of the Visitor Youth Program. Today, Daniel would be considered an incel, harboring an unrequited desire for a neighbor girl, Robin, whose father is the anthropologist hiding in Daniel's garage. Daniel uses this to blackmail the girl, played by Dominic Dunn, who had just made her breakthrough as the older sister in the hit film Poltergeist. Robin is repulsed by his threats, but has a crush of her own on one of the handsome young aliens patrolling her neighborhood. She eventually finds herself carrying his child. The lingering question, what kind of child will it be? Although getting V on track was a harried scramble, the production was finally rolling smoothly when the unthinkable derailed everything. Says Johnson, 4 weeks into the filming, one of my leading ladies was murdered. One Los Angeles Times headline told the story in a brutal summary: Dominic Dunn dies in coma, actress's ex-boyfriend to be arraigned on murder charge. The 22-year-old had been attacked outside her West Hollywood home on October 30, 1982, during an argument with an ex named John Thomas Sweeney, who worked as a sous chef at the trendy restaurant Ma Maison. Her father, journalist Dominic Dunn, would later document the murder trial in Vanity Fair and become a victim's rights advocate after the jury rejected a second-degree murder charge and convicted Sweeney only of voluntary manslaughter and misdemeanor assault. The medical examiner had testified that Dominique's fatal injuries came from being strangled for 4 minutes. Sweeney was released on parole after 3 years and 7 months. The cast of V had become unusually close, and the loss was most agonizing for her castmates. "She was my friend," Grant says. "I said to Dominique, 'You're going to be a big movie star.' She was deeply gifted. I mean, you can see it up there on the screen. You know instantly when someone's got it." Says Johnson, "There's a photo on my wall from our rehearsal. We had one fast weekend of rehearsal. Hers is the only face you can see in this particular angle, and I look at it every morning as I come into my office." Both Grant and Johnson visited Dunn in the hospital, but she was already gone for all intents and purposes. Her brain had been deprived of oxygen for too long during the attack. After 5 days with no hope of recovery, her family took her off life support. That day, V was shooting an all-nighter in downtown Los Angeles for a sequence in which the aliens make first contact at the United Nations. Johnson called the cast and crew together to break the news. "There were a lot of people in tears and leaning on each other. It was all I could do to talk and put words together," he says. "It was like losing one of your children without any warning, and we were all just bludgeoned by it." Packer had been at Dunn's home when she was attacked and would become a key witness in the murder trial. While playing the cat-and-mouse storyline between her, Robin, and his uber-creepy Daniel, the two had struck up a friendship. They had gone to lunch together on the Saturday afternoon before she was attacked, and Packer was there when Sweeney arrived that evening, yelling and pounding on the door. When Dunn finally opened it, Packer later testified that Sweeney looked at him and demanded, "Who's he?" Packer offered to leave and told the court that Dunn shook her head, indicating she wanted him to stay. He remained in the house while Dunn went outside with Sweeney. "I do want to point out that he was a child," Grant says. "He was a very young person when that happened, and he was frightened. And that's really all I can say about that. If you remember how young he was, I think he was only 19. Packer testified in the trial that he took action when he heard screams and tumbling or banging sounds. After placing a call to police, he went outside and found Sweeney kneeling over Dunn, who was lying unconscious in a neighbor's driveway. Packer was not accused of any wrongdoing, but he faced public scorn from those who felt he should have done more. His V colleagues still begged to differ. The group was totally accepting of the fact that he had been part of a tragedy and that it was weighing on him, Johnson says. "Fay and I were sitting with him at the funeral, and he was sobbing, sobbing, sobbing his heart out." Dunn's family declined to comment for this story, preferring not to relive the tragedy. Packer did not respond to requests for an interview. As the deplorable Daniel, the actor, who went on to appear in movies such as RoboCop and Strange Days, along with a long list of TV appearances, remains one of the most chilling aspects of the miniseries. A 22-year-old actor named Blair Tefkin entered a production in mourning. She had just made her screen debut with a small role in Fast Times at Ridgemont High and was asked to fill the part left vacant by Dunn's death. "Someone had to do it, but definitely it was hard," Tefkin says. "Normally, you'd be really excited and happy you got a part, but it was a different kind of experience. An extra week of filming was added to the production to recreate work that Dunn had already completed. We had the physical problem of having to go back and reshoot scenes with a brand new actress who had to step into the role that a beloved person had been playing, Johnson says. Tefkin sums up those reshoots with two words, awkward, she says, sad. Ironically, her Robin is one of the bright spots of V, an effervescent kid who just yearns for things to return to normal when her life is upended. She was the innocent caught up in the crisis. I didn't really think about what she symbolized, Tefkin says. I was thinking more about it from the vantage point of sort of a self-involved teenager. Her life and the world is crumbling. She's interested in boys and her crushes and is pretty tunnel-visioned. After shooting was finished, the V cast and crew gathered one more time for a wrap party to screen the miniseries. The mood was celebratory until the end, when the credits concluded with, in loving memory of Dominique Dunn, her friends miss her. That's when everybody in the room really started crying, Johnson says, that moment. V's debut was a smash with audiences and critics, but V's victory turned out to be a Pyrrhic one for Johnson. NBC wanted more, but Warner Brothers was reluctant to make it. The initial $8 million budget had ballooned to $13 million, and the financials seemed risky. I think it was unclear to them just how valuable this was, says Sagansky, the former NBC exec. Johnson blames V's budget problems on the overtime incurred in the race to finish by May sweeps. The sci-fi element also came with sticker shock. The use of special effects was really unique in television at that time, and because they were so new, it was unclear how much they cost, Sagansky says. Blame fell on Johnson himself, although Sagansky feels that was misguided. I never thought that Kenny got all his due for what he accomplished. NBC finally offered terms that convinced Warner Brothers to greenlight a second miniseries. The sequel would be called V, The Final Battle. Just before production was set to begin, Johnson says he got a call from a Warner Brothers TV executive who said, Kenny, we don't want you to direct any of the sequel. Honest to God, this is a quote. We are afraid you won't direct the sequel as quick and cheap and dirty as we want it done. Johnson was forced out for trying too hard. His pleas to NBC for intervention went nowhere. I called Brandon, of course, and he said, I want to, but the network won't let me meddle with Warner's internal affairs, Johnson says. The actors say they were unhappy to lose him, but contractually obligated to continue. I think it fundamentally changed the nature of the show, Singer says. The overarching politics were underemphasized in comparison to the more adventurous and action elements of the story. We felt that immediately. V, The Final Battle, was still a hit when it aired during the May sweeps of 1984. It included Juliet leading an attack on the visitors during a live television ceremony, during which she held their supreme commander before the cameras, tore at his face, and exposed the reptilian predator beneath. Packer's Daniel met an appropriately karmic end, consumed literally by the alien regime he so dutifully served. Tefkin's Robin gave birth to her visitor-fathered twins, one a human baby with a thin, snake-like tongue, the other a scaly green abomination. I never saw any of this, Johnson says. All of my friends who worked on it said, Kenny, you don't want to see what they did to your original series. You just don't. The Final Battle used parts of his scripts, but Johnson changed his story credit to Lillian Weezer, a combination of the name and nickname of his golden retriever. NBC ordered a weekly series, but Johnson was completely locked out. The result? Ugh, says Sagansky, the worst. V, the series, devolved into campy schlock. Badler noted the changing influences for her militaristic Diana. Stalin and these sorts of very powerful, corrupt leaders were more aware. I was thinking when I did the role, she says. Joan Collins came in later with the series when it became a little bit ridiculous and started to become a soap opera in outer space. Most actors would do anything to secure a lead role on a national network drama, but Grant was desperate to quit. In fact, since I wanted out of it so badly, they kept throwing more and more money at me. She kept proposing ways for Juliet to sacrifice herself for the cause. I mean, I had literally 50 ways to kill me off, and they weren't having it, Grant says. And the direction that the series took, I mean, they tried to write a mud fight between Diana and Juliet, and I wouldn't have it. The audience didn't care for it either. The V series was canceled after only a partial season. Johnson also wasn't involved in the 2009 ABC reboot of V, which had a slightly longer run than its 80s predecessor, with 22 episodes over two seasons. Badler and Singer returned playing different characters, but they were the only connection to the original. The effects were better for sure, but the impact wasn't nearly the same. Johnson went on to develop the Alien Nation TV series in the late 80s and remained active as a producer and director for decades. Today, he is working to revive his own version of V. He's published novels revealing how he actually wanted the story to play out, and his original deal with Warner Brothers stipulated that he controls the movie rights. Although he has no say over V on television, he still hopes to mount a big screen revival. He's now looking for investors willing to buy in. The fandom, he believes, is still out there. He keeps a drawer-sized binder full of letters and emails, many of them penned by people who were just kids when they watched the original miniseries. Many thanked him, not just for the scares and thrills, but for teaching a valuable moral. If I printed all of them, I mean, it would be a stack that would go to the ceiling, he says. Honest to God, it's crazy. But bless their hearts, I love those fans and the fact that so many of them get it. In recent years, however, Johnson began detecting that worrying trend in his inbox. QAnon has adopted a whole thesis that the Democrats are aliens disguised, he says. It was really hard for me to imagine that people could misunderstand to the point of actually believing that there really was a lizard race and that I had been trying to warn everybody. Conspiracy theorists lurking on chat boards and comment threads fervently believe that a secret race of lizard-like beings secretly manipulate the media, government, and banking system. It sounds absurd, but a 2013 public policy polling survey on conspiracy theories found 12 million Americans believe it, about 4% of the country. The theory has actually become a deadly obsession in some cases. In 2020, the FBI said a man sent letters to friends warning about the so-called reptilian conspiracy before killing himself and injuring eight others in a Nashville car bombing. A year later, a man who murdered his two children told investigators he did it because his wife had passed on her serpent DNA. The reptilian cabal theory dates back to the 1800s. Often fueled by anti-Semitic and anti-immigrant sentiments, and used as a way to dehumanize such groups. Johnson, of course, made V to push back on this kind of dehumanizing nonsense, only to find his creation used to propagate it. Social media users regularly highlight wrinkles in the faces of President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris as evidence they are covert lizard people. Not all who misinterpret V are conspiracists. Some are just oblivious. Allegory can deliver a meaningful message in a coded way, but not everyone does the necessary code breaking. Something similar happened to The Matrix when right-wing activists adopted red pilling as shorthand for new people being awakened to their beliefs. England, a favorite at sci-fi conventions around the world, recalls meeting a V superfan who proudly pulled down his collar to show off a neck tattoo of the alien symbol that adorns the V visitor hats, uniforms, and starships. It's a long vertical line with two horizontal dashes extending from the bottom left and top right. Two circles sit at the center. England felt obliged to explain the origin of that symbol. He was horrified to hear it, England says. He literally did not connect the dots, because if you connect the dots, it's a swastika. Johnson is disheartened by this, to say the least. By far, the preponderance of mail that I get are not conspiracy theorists. Yes, they are sprinkled in there. There's no question about it. And more in recent years, he says. He always writes back telling them, "No, if you watch really carefully, what it's really about is this," and I try to nurture them along. The creator of V is still trying to make his point, even if it's one person at a time. Now, here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Ryan McAmis, Sir Elton John, the music legend whose farewell concert could earn him an Emmy and an EGOT, sounds off on attitude, addiction, and the perils of a stiff upper lip. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Being with my husband David and the boys. What is your greatest extravagance? Flowers. Which living person do you most despise? How long have you got? What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? My temper. What or who is the greatest love of your life? David, Zachary, and Elijah. When and where were you happiest? Today, at home. What is your favorite occupation? Singing. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? A stiff upper lip, which is the cancer of the United Kingdom. On what occasion do you lie to be kind? What do you dislike most about your appearance? My profile. Which talent would you most like to have? I'd love to be able to paint. Which living person do you most admire? AIDS activist Jeannie White Gender. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Entitlement, arrogance, and bigotry. What is your favorite journey? Going home. Which words or phrases do you most overuse? Nightmare. What is your greatest regret? Addiction. What is your current state of mind? Tranquil. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? My short arms. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? Batman. How would you like to die? Peacefully. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? Nothing. What do you consider your greatest achievement? Sobriety. What is it that you most dislike? Attitude. It's always the untalented ones that are the worst. If you could choose what to come back as, what would it be? An elephant. What is your most treasured possession? My sobriety coins. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? Ending your career as a has-been. Where would you like to live? Where I live now in Old Windsor. What is your most marked characteristic? Enthusiasm. What do you most value in your friends? Loyalty at all cost. Who are your favorite writers? Tennessee Williams and Charles Dickens, but I mostly read biographies, memoirs, and diaries. Who are your heroes in real life? People who care for the sick and needy. What is your greatest fear? Dying, because I am so happy now. What is your motto? Never look back. And that was the Proust Questionnaire with Sir Elton John. We'll be right back. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock. Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock, Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.